and welcome to Happy Horror Time. I'm Tim Murdoch.
And I'm Matt Emmert. And if you've listened to some of our past interviews, you've noticed we've talked to a lot of people from classic horror movies that came out a while ago. Well, we also love talking to people from new and upcoming horror movies, so we're going to start doing that too. And today we have with us the writer-director of a hot new horror movie called Dreamcatcher that was just released on demand like 2 days ago, Friday, March 5th. We are incredibly excited to welcome to the podcast Jacob Johnston.
Woo! Hooray!
Woo!
It's so great to be here, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. How's it going? I'm sure things have been crazy lately with the release of the film and everything.
It's been, which is nice. I feel like if you can use the word crazy in talking about your daily life in the throes of a pandemic, that's, you know, a testament to, you know,
especially when crazy, feeling
pretty grateful and excited about that.
Cool. Yeah. I was going to say, especially when crazy doesn't have to do with the pandemic and it's about something different.
Yes. Yeah. 100%. But it's, you know, it's good. It's, I've really, you know, we shot this movie a couple years ago. In January of 2019. So now to be, you know, here in March of 2021 with it coming out, it feels like you've kind of come full circle and now you're getting to talk about the movie and you've, you know, for a while you've just held on to this almost like a secret that no one could talk about. And so now it's really exciting to be able to share that.
That's awesome. Okay, so, you know, before we dive into Dreamcatcher, we have a ton of questions, but I wanted to kind of talk to you about you, actually. And I noticed on IMDb that you are originally from Oklahoma. And I'm just wondering, what was it like growing up there and just kind of coming of age in that part of the country?
I only lived there till I was five. So we moved around quite a bit. When I was growing up, we moved to Tennessee after we left Oklahoma, lived there and moved around to a few different cities there. And we moved to Colorado for a year. And then eventually my parents separated and my brother and mom and I moved to Kentucky because we have family there. And my dad moved back to Tennessee. So I it's not too different than growing. I mean, it's still the Midwest, whether you're Kentucky, Tennessee or Oklahoma, but it's, I don't know. There's a inherent level of politeness that gets baked into you, and you know there's a moral compass that you kind of gravitate toward, and you just learn to appreciate the small things in life. I think growing up in the Midwest.
I'm from Ohio. I relate.
So you get it.
I was just gonna say it must have been culture shock when you came to LA and saw all that kindness just disappear.
Yeah, especially when you get on the freeway and you're like.
You're like, whoa, people are very, very nice and sweet on the freeway.
The 405.
Especially when a red light switches to green. And if you don't go in a matter of a second, someone's beeping you.
Yeah, beeping at you. I'm 100% that person.
Or like people's inability to understand a four-way stop.
I'm guilty of that too.
Wow.
Well, that's really cool, though, because I guess it gives you a different perspective, especially coming from maybe teaches you humility, I guess, like, which is nice to have.
It is. Yeah. I do feel that LA gets a little bit of a harsh rap because it is really a city of orphans or a city of transplants. You know, it is a place where a lot of people come from a lot of different, you know, whether it's the Midwest, whether it's the Northeast, like it attracts a lot of different people for better or for worse. But I do believe that this is, you know, it's not all superficial, vapid, empty people or fame obsessed crazies. There's still a level of humility that I think is baked into most of Los Angeles.
Yeah,
fingers crossed.
Yeah, well, yeah. I was going to say that. Let me correct the record here. I'm not bad. I actually grew up in Southern California, so I can.
You're terrible.
No. So what I'm saying, I can joke about because now I did not grow up in LA. I grew up an hour east of LA, but like I joke about it. But you're totally right. Like the amount of people that grew up in LA is much less than the people that have come here from different areas and bring their shared or different sort of culture and everything like that. But
Okay, now my next question. Growing up, were you always a horror fan?
It's funny. I wasn't really. When I was in the fourth grade, I saw The Shining for the first time. That was kind of like my first introduction to horror. But I was like tangentially watching it, where it was like I was in the kitchen and they were watching in the living room. And I just remember being absolutely terrified. I had no idea what was going on. Like I didn't understand the story at all. But that scene with Jack Nicholson in the bathroom. And that, you know, the old lady, I was just like nightmares for weeks. But it's
wait, isn't that the fully nude, decrepit old lady? Yeah,
sure was. Sure was.
If there was a time I realized I was gay, it could have been. Just kidding. No. That it's so funny that you mentioned that scene though, because so many people, when they mention The Shining, I think like the most iconic scenes, the two girls, the twins in the hallway, Red Brum, and then him with the bat with Shelley Duvall going up the stairs. But you're totally right, because that scene is terrifying.
It's terrifying. And it's also not like, I don't think that scene really represents the movie as a whole, because there's a lot of The Shining that is so atmospheric, mm-hmm. and it's so like, still, and that scene is not that. It is like straight up almost Cronenberg horror, where it's like body horror, and like it's different to me than, you know, even the twins. Like that there's a stillness there. And
who's your favorite horror director?
That's tough, because I feel like I can't really pick one person.
Were there any horror movies specifically that have either like inspired you or had an impact on you in terms of, if you not, you know, I know it's tough to pick like one director, but maybe there's a few horror movies or styles that have had an impact.
Yeah, I think it was honestly when I saw Scream for the first time that I realized that horror movies didn't have to be, they didn't have to be a certain kind of horror. It was a slasher, but it was also funny. And it was also kind of just like Dawson's Creek, but like with murder. So it's, you know, you get this. I love your shirt.
I'm just sorry. It's not a visual medium.
What are you doing?
I'm just showing off my I'm for people listening, I'm wearing one of my favorite shirts, which says, "What's your favorite scary movie?" and has the ghost face. Obviously, I'm a huge Scream fan, but go on.
But it really did show like this different aspect, I think, of horror. And it was before I saw, you know, the original Halloween or the original Nightmare on Elm Street, or any of kind of what we consider the classics, or even as far back as like the Italian cinema with stuff like Suspiria or Tenebrae. After Scream, it was seeing the Final Destination franchise. And then after, you know, the Final Destination franchise, it was diving back in, you know, to the stuff from 50s and 60s. Psycho is one of my mom's favorite movies, so I was, you know, exposed to that. And it's one of my favorite horror movies now. So yeah, it wasn't really probably until I was in high school, maybe late middle school, high school, that I started to see so much inspiration in horror movies because of really how the characters unfolded. You know, I think those are transformative years. I was, you know, fat and awkward and bullied in middle school. So you watch these movies where there's so much adversity and you have to overcome that in a really thrilling way. And I latched onto that, and I think found a way to really appreciate the horror genre in a different light than just being like thrilled by it.
Yeah, no, that's cool. I mean, wow, yeah, that's a great answer. I think a lot of people are just thrilled by it or are seeking out some sort of thrill, but to have kind of sort of a connection in that way, that's great. You know, I wanted to kind of go through your evolution into the film industry, I guess. I noticed that you have a ton of credits as visual development producer, and I was just wondering, what exactly does that entail, that role on a film?
Sure. It was, when I started at Marvel, the department was created when I started there. And it was when the studio was still fairly small. You know, we were doing, when I got hired, it was right before the first Captain America was about to shoot. So we were doing Thor and Captain America at the time. And I was hired alongside these two people, Charlie Wynn and Ryan Meyerding, who were really establishing the visual language of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Then Ryan designed all the Captain America suits. Charlie designed almost every one of the characters in Thor. Another artist, Andy Park, came in and started working with us. And I was, you know, on the administrative coordinated side at first as a coordinator and then eventually moving to producer. But it was a department that Marvel created really to keep a visual consistency through all of the films. You know, it's figuring out really the characters, costumes, weapons, props, and action sequences on these films.
Did you work on all three Iron Man?
I did.
Did you meet Gwen?
No. Oh, no. I didn't work on... I didn't work on the first one. That came out when I was in high school.
After like this, no, that's hilarious. Just because it's like, it's so Tim. Like, you have this great answer about like all the meticulous things you did on the film. And Tim's like, did you meet Gwyneth? Let's cut that out to the chase.
She doesn't wear an outfit. I know.
Funny story though about Gwen Paltrow. Yes. So when I was an intern, they were in post on Iron Man 2. And I had this like little cubicle because I was interning when I first started in animation. This is when I was still in college. And she had come in for some reason and she had left her kids in the car. And I guess they were bored and needed something to do. So she like was walking down past my, and I had a Mr. Potato Head Iron Man. Well, I guess now he's non-binary Potato Head.
That's
but
right.
He had an Iron Man suit, and she was like, I need to borrow this. And she took my Potato Head Iron Man and brought it out for her kids to play with, and I never saw it again.
And and you're like, okay, so Gwyneth.
Oh, she sent you some goop.
Gwyneth, out here, you owe Jacob a non-binary Potato Head, so it's got to be recent. It's
I saw her review.
She's one of our biggest listeners, just so you know.
Yeah.
She actually gave me one, but I didn't get a finish. She gave me
one. Oh, sorry. Okay, I take that back, Gwyneth. Yeah. You're good. We're good.
She doesn't have to. Yeah, I've got this Mr. Non-binary Iron Man Potato Head.
That's awesome.
Did she sign it though?
No.
Gwyneth, always dropping the ball.
Dropping.
I guess then, obviously, that is a very different role than writing and directing a film. Were you always interested in writing and directing film, or was that an interest you realized later on in life?
No, it absolutely was. I think the thing that was daunting to me was when I was in film school, there were 65 directors in my class, and I suddenly like realized like through my course studies, I was like, I don't know if I necessarily have to emphasize in directing. I'm also really fascinated by production design. And there's only three production design emphasis. There's only three of those in our class. You have to, the first class you have in film school is visual storytelling. So you have to be able to understand the medium of no dialogue and finding those motifs and the symbolism and all of that in the production design, the costumes, because it all feeds into the story.
Dreamcatcher is like mind candy because it's so beautiful. Like the production, it looks like I know it takes place in a rave, but it looks like a really glossy Vogue club.
It's almost like a visual development producer had written and directed this. Very weird.
It's strange. It's so bizarre.
Yeah. Well, moving forward, and don't worry, we will dive into Dreamcatcher. But before we get into that, I wanted to talk about a short film that you wrote and directed. I think it may have been your first Cadence. Was that the first short film that you wrote and directed?
That was my first post film school. I don't count really anything that I did in film school as any. Thing since I feel like it was so long ago.
Well, first off, it's available on Amazon Prime for everyone
that's
listening.
Impressive.
Random horror connection that I have to bring up just because I'm someone who loves like the 6 degrees of horror Kevin Bacon type stuff. But okay, so the very good looking Max Lloyd Jones, who was in your short, who played Caden in your short, was Bella Thorne's boyfriend in the opening scene of the first season of Scream TV series. So he's actually the first person killed by Ghostface in that TV series. He's decapitated. Well, first off, did you watch the TV series? So you know,
I did.
Okay,
yeah.
So you knew because it was like the year before and he's like decapitated and his head falls in the spa with Bella Thorne. But it was such a so I take it. Did you know that he was in that before you cast him? And did the decapitation just seal the deal to get him in your short?
Well, actually, what had happened was we had originally cast Connor Jessup. To play that role. And Connor and I had all these conversations. We were gonna fly him in from Canada. He was at the time on a hiatus from Falling Skies, the show that he was on for TNT. Obviously this was before he kind of blew up with Lock and Key and all this other stuff, but he was gonna play the lead and then some other stuff happened and he got cast in a film and it was like we couldn't push our dates and so we gotta go back to the drawing board and I saw Max's audition and they had a very similar look and we had already cast Bailey to play the father, so I knew it was like find somebody that looked similarly like they could be related, but I did not know really that because we shot that actually in 2015, so it was before Scream actually happened. So it was, I think that was the thing he did right after we finished shooting.
Decapitated.
Gets decapitated.
No, it's such a funny thing because, and obviously being a Scream fan, I mean, even though it's a very small role that he has in it, it's, it's the Scream TV series, I think anybody would want to be in that kind of thing. But, okay, so now jumping into Dreamcatcher. So just to set it up, I feel like let's say someone who hasn't heard anything whatsoever about the film wants to know what it's all about. How would you, obviously being the writer and director, describe the plot to them?
I would say it's about two estranged sisters who come together with their friends to attend this underground music festival. And while at the festival, a kind of crazy traumatic event happens, and the rest of the film follows the aftermath of this event. And part of that entails a masked killer who seems to be hunting down the ensemble. So it kind of has the facade of a typical slasher, but some additional elements as well.
Oh, then
awesome.
No,
go ahead.
Oh no, I was just going to say, usually Tim and I are known for spoiling everything when we discuss
We're
movies.
We're not going to do that today.
But we decided that because this episode is going to be coming out literally the weekend that we wanted to time this so that it came out the weekend that your film is released, we are going to refrain from spoiling a lot of it because we usually talk about movies like a few weeks after, but we don't want to spoil this one for people.
So the killer is.
Yeah. So no spoilers, but here's what happens.
No spoilers, but everybody. No.
Okay. So is this the first film you've written and directed? I mean, do you have other scripts that are like, how did this one?
First feature. Is this the first feature?
Yeah. First feature. And it was honestly a situation of opportunity more than anything. I had probably written about 8 or 9, 10 movies prior to this. And I had known Brandon and Crystal, the producers, for probably about 5 years. And they had just finished doing this movie with Wes Craven called The Girl in the Photographs that they had produced. And we met at a barbecue and we were talking about kind of our love for 90s ensemble and how they don't really do that often anymore. And we had stayed in contact over the years, you know, talking about trying to find something to do together. And out of the blue, I got a call from Brandon and he was like, hey, so we have some financing. And we really would love to make a movie and we'd love to sit down and talk to you about that. And so the initial conversation was really, we'd love to do a love letter to the 90s in some capacity. We'd love to, you know, kind of make an homage to Wes Craven in some way. And also we'd love it to be in the world of music in some way. And originally there was an idea that they had that maybe it would deal with like a Post Malone-esque character who's kind of in this like hip hop world. And I just felt that I couldn't find the in for that personally. Like I just didn't like I, to me that I was not super inspired by that. And I was like, I don't know. And so I started to think about it more and I came up with this idea to set it in the world of EDM because we're in this zeitgeist. EDM is so popular right now. And it's like this cultural movement. And it also solved a lot of problems in terms of how do you, you know, the masked character, how do you create a character that you don't have to establish, you know, lengthy mythos for, where I'm going to spend 30 minutes trying to give a backstory to why this person wears a specific mask. So it kind of answered that question quite simply. It was like Deadmau5, Marshmello, Daft Punk. Yeah. And we don't ask questions, you know, that's just what it is. And, you know, if anybody were to wear that mask, why would anybody, if somebody puts on the Deadmau5 helmet, it's not going to be like, why is somebody doing that? Like, yeah. You know, so it created a lot of opportunity. And so I really wrote the movie around this phone call saying, hey, we want to make a movie. And you know, the story just kind of came from there.
First off, and it's funny, you basically answered my next question, which was going to be how it came to be. But have to congratulate you on and just am you had done shorts before this, but you obviously have enough clout in the industry that people are coming to you to ask you to do. How did you get to that status? But really, I mean, like I'm incredibly envious. I'm sure many people would be because this was your first film and you had people coming to you asking you to do it. How did you get that status? You know?
I think it was because of my relationship with Brandon and Crystal and having known them for so many years. And we had tried to put together a movie, you know, a few years back and it didn't work out because the financing fell through. And it was really we really believe in you as a filmmaker type situation and seeing me grow through doing different shorts and music videos. And I think there was a rallying point there to be like, we really want to do this together. And bring this to life in a meaningful way. And so I do, you know, you never know when those relationships are going to, you know, I don't want to say pay off, but like when they're going to come full circle, you know, like we meet people in life and you never know if it's going to take 2 years, 3 years, 10, like, so just, you know, treat every opportunity like it could be a huge opportunity.
Yeah, and don't burn bridges.
I burn all my bridges.
Yeah, Tim just, the second Tim gets an opportunity, he's like,
I'm like, get out.
No, I mean, that's that is crazy. And I was going to ask about, because at first I didn't know if the plot came from, like, if you were like a circuit boy or something, like, or what. No, because I didn't know, have you been to EDM festivals? I mean, obviously you must have some proficiency in that area because you wrote about it and chose to wrote that style, you know?
It was really inspired by its song. I was like walking after 2 days after Brandon and Crystal and I had our first discussion about making this movie. And also we were on a timeline. This was in like September and they wanted to shoot in January. So it was like, we need to get the script. We need to move. And so I was walking to get some dinner and this EDM song came on and it was just like, wait, why not this? Like it's got a heartbeat to it. There is a melody that is so intrinsically, I think, tied to actual, you know, story structure where you've got these highs and lows, you know, and if you can create a level of spontaneity where like, we don't know when the beat's going to drop and kind of mirror that in a narrative. Like there was just so many things that I was really drawn to that were kind of independent of, you know, me being some super EDM fan. I would say like, I did as much research as I could, but I wouldn't say that it was like, I was writing from sheer experience.
Oh, you mean you didn't do years of shirt off Molly taking circuit parties for research?
No. When do we get to do those?
Well, there goes our next question. No.
I was going to jump a little bit ahead, and I was going to ask, like, I love your composer. I listened to the Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street soundtrack. It was in my car for a year. So I like that music is ingrained in my skull. I think that's such a good get for your movie. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, how did you guys get connected? I think his name is
Tyler
or Alexander.
Alexander Taylor, right?
Yeah. Yes, sir.
And Tyler. Yes.
Tyler.
His name's Tyler.
Well, I called him Tyler for short. But I met him at a film festival actually when I had Cadence going. He had a film screening that he had composed, and Cadence was screening in the same block of shorts that his was. And he came up to me afterwards and we just started talking. And that was in 2016. And I knew that he was, you know, this big genre guy, but also just like his understanding of music theory. Like when you actually talk to Alexander, it's just like mind boggling, like the things he's just coming up with. And I have a big affinity for people like Charlie Clouser, who use strange, he did Saw and Dead Silence. And he used to be the keyboardist in Nine Inch Nails. But he, you know, when you read about some of the stuff he's come up with, he uses like, you know, the strings of his staircase to pluck and like just very out of the box stuff. And I think Alex brings that same level of thinking. And he also understands 80s synth stuff, you know, the new wave stuff that I really like, and blending those two things together.
I love synth. How about the costume for Dreamcatcher? Where did you come up? Scratch that, edit that. Were you involved with the design of the Dreamcatcher look?
Yeah, the DJ's costume.
Not at all. I was not at all involved in I was, yeah. I am listed.
No, I mean, some people, I mean, you hear about, it's like, I always reference Halloween because it's my favorite movie of all time, the original. And, you know, I think John Carpenter asked Tommy Lee Wallace to like, just get a scary mask, and like came back with three. And then they picked the one that was the William Shatner. Like, there's always a story. But anyway, we were interested in the story of how your costume came to be.
Yeah, it was so much of, as you guys know, with this genre, is like establishing your iconography is like really a baseline point that you have to hit right. Because if it's done poorly, if it feels too cheap or it feels silly, or there's just a weird balance you have to strike when you're finding that design. And it does inform so much of the story. But when I was writing the script, I didn't quite know exactly what I wanted it to be. I knew it needed to be modern and had to feel sleek, and it also had to be something that if a DJ was wearing it, it didn't feel egregious, and like it couldn't be scary enough that people wouldn't want to watch him play music. So, you know, but in the right lighting it could be scary. And so I started working with one of my old Marvel colleagues, Josh Herman, who designed like Groot for Guardians of the Galaxy. He designed many of the Iron Man suits for the Iron Man films, and he's just a really brilliant artist, but he also is great at taking things into three-dimensional space. So once we started doing some sketches, and by that I mean he started doing some sketches, we found kind of the design language we wanted to use, more of like an exaggerated human face with some owl-esque design elements, like the eyes and kind of the way that the face comes down, and then using the weaving of a dream catcher kind of inlaid into the mask and using the eyepiece as the center of the dream catcher. And the original idea was that it would light up, that the lines would kind of ignite, and it just became, one, a budgetary issue, and two, it was kind of a safety issue, baking in all of this electrical work into the mask when they're doing stunts or they're running, and like, so we kind of scrapped that idea. And honestly, I think it could have worked against us because I think it could have gotten too sci-fi. and also there's a little bit of you know, Brian De Palma's Phantom of the Paradise, you know, which also deals with Faust, with also deal, like there's some, you know, a little bit of an homage to that as well.
When I first saw the mask, do you remember in the movie Beetlejuice when he goes like this and pulls his eyes down? Have you heard that before? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I mean, I've seen that. Yes, I know what that is.
Yeah. Actually, he's like, that was 100% the inspiration.
Beetlejuice.
It was all Beetlejuice. I actually saw somebody the other day whose nose was like so elongated, I actually thought it looked exactly like that as well.
How dare you talk about me that way?
Here's Matt Emmer.
How dare you? You saw my dad. No.
Leave Larry out.
I know. So your writing style, it reminds me a lot of Kevin Williamson's, actually. He's one of my all-time like favorite horror writing idols. His characters, you know, are always very well spoken, much more than one dimensional. I just want to know, did you purposely set out to write very intelligent characters? Because, you know, that's something you don't see a lot in horror. And I also want to know, do you think my comparison of your writing style to Kevin Williamson is accurate, or am I completely off?
I hope that people will echo your sentiments, because that's a huge compliment, I think, because I love his writing. And I think not only is it the self-awareness that he brings to the characters, but also he has a way with just tying the story together so neatly. Mm-hmm. And like every scene leads into, you know, we also saw in Teaching Miss Tingle, like it's the same kind of, like everything leads into the next scene in a meaningful way. And even the kind of ancillary characters feel like they have a purpose for being there, and something that I was really keen on. And I really did. I watched Scream 2 probably 5 or 6 times each while writing this, because I was looking at not only the film, but how it's structured. It's a long first act. It's a very kind of shortened second act, and it's a really long third act. Sure. And, you know, so I think that trying to emulate that similar setup, for better or for worse, like I think some people will feel the second act lags because it's not just kill scene, kill scene, kill scene, kill scene. But I think that it's more effective than you begin in Scream, for instance. You get the opening death with Drew, and then we're not killing anybody else until the principal, like 35, 40 minutes into the movie.
Which was added.
Yeah, he was required to add in because there had been so long between kill scenes. So that wasn't even in the original script, which is funny. But go on, sorry.
But it's the same idea. And that's why I do believe that there will be a divisive kind of thing. I knew going in where it's like, why are there not more people getting, you know, brutalized? But the intention was to kind of, like you said, find ways to make people who are more than one-dimensional. And in order to do that, we really do have to have reprieves. There has to be a moment of like respite before they can actually like talk or like emote or like deal in horror. You know, what I see happening so often, and you have to do it in some movies, but it's like your best friend's butchered, and then the very next scene I'm, you know, having sex with somebody, or like it's, you know,
it relaxes you.
Tim, actually, one of Tim's coping methods for death is
day,
having sex.
Day.
Yeah. Yes. Anyway, I don't know why I said that. I have never had sex with Tim. I'm just going to put that out there, but you know, I do know his coping methods.
Thank you.
Okay.
It is that.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, and it was thank you so much for saying that. I do hope that I love self-aware, intelligent characters who also maybe all sound like they're the smartest person in the room, but to different degrees. Like, I think that, you know, you can be witty and intelligent, but like your sense of humor is different from somebody else's, and like how you choose to use, like, I think it can, you can be really intellectual, but not all sound the exact same.
Of course.
Well, and there's one thing I found in common was that all of the cast is a beautiful young cast. And I just wanted to know, what was your hand in the casting process?
Yes, they're all incredibly good looking. Everybody's incredibly good looking.
I appreciate the girls too.
Yeah, I mean, we appreciate the girls, but you got some very good looking men in that.
And
so
they like to take showers.
Sure.
Yes. How involved were you in that casting process, and what was that like?
It was like old school, to be perfectly honest. We did, you know, the self-tape side of things, and then we did we brought in the people we really liked. And then after we kind of narrowed, we did mix and matches just to see how the chemistry would be between these characters, because so much of this film is contingent upon a believable chemistry between the characters, for better or worse. Like, if the friendships are there, if the history is there, if the like weird sexual tension is there, like it kind of all needed to be there. Like, you can discover some of it on the day, but the more you can be aware of the fact, like if they're going to have zero chemistry, you can avoid that. And then it was honestly like some of the, you know, it would be with the producers, they would have some, it would be very much like one for you, one for me type situation, where if I was really excited about somebody that maybe they were a little on the fence with, then I would be like, well, we're really excited about this person. So
you have to negotiate.
And that's filmmaking in general. But, you know, in the end, I think that there's some really attractive people and they don't wear a lot of clothes all the time. So it's great.
Well, I have to say, and this is going to make me sound perverted, but whatever, you know, as a gay man, of course, we were, of course, hoping for some male nudity. And I'm just wondering if it's because, well, you know, the horror genre is famous for exploiting women mostly. So now I almost feel like it's like we're trying to catch up by maybe adding male nudity in. And I was just saying, had you
was there talk about
like people, male men showering. And so I was like, this actually wouldn't even be exploitative. This would just be nice. But I'm just, but you did steer away from that.
We're guys in the film anti-butt?
No, the original conversation was there was going to be butt. There was going to be two butt. There was going to be upper butt on Ivy when she's in the shower, and there was going to be side butt on Dylan at the end. Mm-hmm. Not to spoil it, but there was going to be butt. So,
but the
reality of it became I didn't want the film to seem exploitive, and it would I think. Honestly, both of those shower situations are really art housey scenes anyway, so it probably would have been fine had we done it. And actually, Elizabeth Posey, who used to be a model and plays Ivy in the film, like she was 100% on board with it. Like she had no, it was like top off, you know, pants. But it was also the day that like one of our lead actresses' mother was on set. And like there was just so many things that was like we need to be very careful about how this is done. And the last thing I wanted to do in the film is make anybody feel exploited or like overly sexualized.
Yeah. And just so you know, I kind of asked that in jest. I mean, I really, would it have added anything?
Well,
no.
When
like, I mean,
Matt
no.
And I made our film. He was always like, when are you going to get naked? It was sick.
Oh yeah. I said, Tim, fans are screaming for nudity from you.
Yes.
They want,
why didn't that happen?
Yeah, I know, but I didn't want to exploit Tim because I feel like he exploits himself. Enough.
Right. That's right.
No,
through his coping mechanisms.
Yeah, yes. No, that's very respectful. Actually, if anything, it was in a way, it's admirable that you did steer away from it. It's just like, oh my God, your cast was so good looking. It was like painful. They were all so good looking, male and female. So another thing I was going to ask you about, which I think again very admire in this film, was that, as you know, within the horror genre, there's a ton of subgenres. There's slasher, supernatural, psychological thriller, revenge fantasy, creature feature. But I feel like this film, it kind of extends into almost all of those categories, with the exception of creature feature. Is that how you would characterize it? Like, it kind of blends the lines between these subgenres.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it is where we're seeing the trend go with horror. There is a melding of genres that is happening within horror, and we're seeing it, you know, with something like Christopher Landon's Happy Death Day, where he's blending, you know, all of these different kinds of, I would say also subgenre type films. Same thing with Hereditary, you know, it blended psychological with supernatural, with atmospheric dread-based horror. Like, it's, and we saw a lot of that kind of in the late 70s, early 80s, where, you know, when you have things like The Exorcist, where it was like, or Rosemary's Baby, where it was like, let's blend, you know, psychological horror with atmospheric horror with like some slasher or creature element. Mm-hmm. But I think we're kind of getting a little bit of that back, you know, with what's going on and the changing of the genre. And if you can find ways to blend it and not feel hopefully contrived, I think then that's kind of fun, or finding ways to subvert what we know about those genre tropes, you know, especially in the slasher genre with those archetypes of characters and those kind of things. I think are really fun to explore if you can do it in a way that doesn't feel like it's a detriment to, you know, the narrative.
Yeah. Were there any aspects of your initial script that didn't end up in the final film that you wish were included? I mean, obviously spoiler free, but at the same time, you know, whatever, if the, any aspects that didn't, that they got cut from the final film.
There's actually, so the original cut of the film, my cut of the film, which would be, even now I look back, I'm like, it was 2 hours and about 18 minutes long.
Oh, wow.
And I know, you know, most people say the movie's long anyway, because it runs, you know, an hour and 42 or whatever, which, or 44, but there's one scene that I'm a little bummed didn't make it. I understand why it was cut out, but there was a reconciliation scene between, this will only make sense for people that see the movie, but it's not spoiling it, but between Jake and Hunter before the big finale. There was this moment of these two characters who are really at opposite ends of the spectrum, and they have a come together moment, and you really get to see a different side to both of them in a big way. And the problem that was like a 5 minute scene, and it was just very emotional and kind of heavy, and it's like right in the throes of getting ready to set up for this massive party scene. So it's like build, and then there was this big scene, and then it was like back to the party. So the pacing just kind of didn't work, but it was a bit of a bummer because I know from the actor's point of view, it was like one of their favorite scenes they got to do, because there was a lot to dive into. But, you know, look for it on Blu-ray at Walmart. Maybe you'll get that extra scene.
Definitely with the commentary track by you.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to spoil the ending, but do you think there's room for a Dreamcatcher 2? And would that be something that you'd be interested in writing and directing?
I already wrote it.
Oh, you,
it's done.
I can't believe you wrote me a role. You're crazy.
So you've already written a sequel. Okay. So when you wrote this, did you have it in mind already that it would be a more than one film series?
I think it's important. I think if anything, I can glean again from the Marvel days is the importance of IP in terms of it has to be franchisable. And I don't think you should ever write something that is predicated on the sole fact that it has to have a sequel. But I think if you can bake in franchise potential, it just adds to the value of whatever IP you have. I'm, you know, kind of cagey about talking about a sequel, because you never know. Like, I think it's, you know, the first film has to be successful and so many things have to come together. But, you know, me and the producers were really excited about where we could go with it. And I had this idea and I was like, hey, so I'm just going to go ahead and write it. And, you know, during the process, I would send them pages and be like, this, and they'd be like, yeah, keep going. So yeah, we have a draft, and it's big. It's, you know, I think what's great about a sequel is you can also go, you know, you could crack that egg open a bit more and really unpack the story in a big way.
No, that's great. Wow. I wasn't expecting that answer, and I'm happy to hear that. I think that's a really cool thing that you already are thinking ahead, you know what I mean? Because that shows obviously that you believe in your work, you're dedicated to it. I would take it you'd want to direct it also.
I think it's also because the style, the tone is very similar. And I would love to be able to stay attached to that world as much as possible, and the characters involved for sure.
So obviously a Dreamcatcher 2 possibly. And then what's up for you like right now? Like what's going on right now?
Like any other projects in development or?
Yeah, I'm talking to you guys and this is great.
I mean, well, that it should be the top of your list.
This is the priority of my life. No, I've got a few things cooking that I'm reluctant to talk about. One, for breaking NDA, and two, for, you know, the shake of jinxing things. But I spent a lot of last year focusing on putting as many irons and as many fires as possible. I think the reality of this industry, as I'm sure you know, is like, your value is kind of determined on whatever you have at any given point. So the more value you can have, just like whether it's scripts or whether it's pitches or whether it's like the fact that you have a movie coming out, if you don't have, you know, that, like for me last year was a little bit of a bust too, because Dreamcatcher wasn't out. So anytime I was in a pitch or trying to convince somebody to hire me to direct something else, it was like, yeah, so when's your movie coming out? You know, so it kind of puts you in a position of you need people to actually see your work before they hire you to do more of that.
Yeah. Well, that actually leads me into, we just have two more questions for you, but into one of the final questions, I wanted to ask, what would be your advice to, say, someone who wants to be a filmmaker, maybe wants to even direct a write and direct their own horror movie, but has no idea where to start or, you know, how to break into the field? Because you obviously have been successful breaking into this field, you know, taking a slightly different approach through the, in the production side, but what would be your advice to someone who just doesn't know how to start and break into this field?
I think what you just said is exactly what I would say, which is that there is no one way to do it. Everybody's filmmaking path is extremely different, and where they start and where they end and everything that kind of happens along the way, it will help them. It will hopefully only help them and inform their storytelling sensibilities. But in the now, you just got to find ways to stay inspired. I think it's so easy, you know, when you feel frustrated or you feel flummoxed about something, it's easy to not feel inspired and to keep going. And so however you as a person can find a way to be inspired, and whether that's writing, whether that's singing, whether that's, you know, directing shorts with your phone, just find a way to just stay in it and invest yourself into that, because it'll take time. Maybe it'll happen overnight. For some people, it does.
TikTok,
but for other people,
TikTok.
Yeah. Listen, if it makes you feel fulfilled in some way, do it. And don't do it because you think it's the right way to go about doing something. You know, you really be mindful, study trends, read, research. You know, like doing your homework does go a long way in this field. Like, if you notice that nobody's buying Westerns and sci-fi movies, don't spend all your time wasting, you know, writing sci-fi Western movies.
Damn it. There goes my Western sci-fi script. Crash.
Yeah. Throw it away.
Yeah.
No, but yeah, just it's just find that inspiration and hopefully hold on to it.
Yeah.
I can't just. Yeah.
No, I think that's great advice. I really do. We have two more questions. Oh, you have another?
I have two questions.
Oh, okay.
I think it's the wrap-up question. Well, first off, obviously, because there's a pandemic, is there like any kind of screening for the cast and crew? And my other question is, who do you like the best, Freddy, Jason, or Michael Myers?
Unfortunately, there was talk for a while about doing a drive-in premiere and kind of like celebrate, but we all decided collectively, with the world being as much in disarray and a lot of the things that are going on, the last thing we want to do is really overly celebrate when there's so much strife going on. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, to really not try to take away from the struggles of the world, and you know, we can put this movie out and hopefully people can enjoy it and from their home. But we didn't want to add any extra, like, look at us, we're having this premiere, and it just didn't feel like the right time to do that. But maybe, you know, I think there's always going to be another movie. Yeah, so maybe down the road. And so I would say Freddy Krueger would be my pick of the three, just because of I think there's so much you can do with him as a character. Like, I feel like Jason has its limitations. Like, he's kind of just like mindless killing machine, and Michael's kind of like a mindless killing machine, and there's some history to unpack with him, but I feel like with Freddy, there's just a lot of mythology and really interesting ways you could take that character. And,
you know, I was really starting to like you, Jacob, until you didn't answer that question with Michael Myers, and now
love
we're
Michael
not
Myers. Love
yeah,
Myers.
Well, I'm a Michael Myers guy, and it's funny because Tim is a Jason guy, so I guess Jason. You put the three of us together, and no,
we'll kill people.
Yeah,
we'll kill you.
So our final question, we ask everyone we interview this, what is one thing you can tell us about your experience working on Dreamcatcher that you haven't told any other interviewer, PR person or whatever? And especially, it should all be fresh in your head because you've been doing interviews this week, but you got to tell us one thing that you have not told anybody else. And it could be the tiniest little thing, maybe from behind the scenes or an Easter egg to look for, but something you haven't told any other interviewer.
That's a great, 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 great question.
Side butt.
Look for side butt. No. Wow. Okay, two things. One is that the finale of the film actually changed because the original idea, I'm going to do this as delicately as possible without spoiling anything. The original finale took place inside the house. And one of the major death sequences took place at the pool. And when we were scheduled the night we were scheduled to shoot the pool death scene, it was pouring rain. Like, I mean, it came out of nowhere. And this is Los Angeles, the one day during our shoot. It's like pouring down rain. We have 3 days of the shoot left. We can't really move anything around. So I have to rewrite that death scene. And because I had to rewrite that death scene, it changed kind of the last 15 minutes in terms of not the actual finale itself, but like the lead up to it. And because of that, we actually moved the finale outside, which to me was so incredible because I love how that actually came out.
Yeah.
You know, so while it was extremely kind of flustering on the day to be like, okay, I got to rewrite this scene and film it. And then also figure out how we're going to do the finale tomorrow and like keep all of the things that need to happen in that finale. But it became way more actually cinematic that we moved the finale to where it ends up being. But because of the one day of rain, and if you watch the movie again, the scene when the kids arrive at the house and Josephine's talking to them when it's over the shoulder, you can see through the window, the trees are like blustery and pouring down rain. And then like later in the night, it's not that, but yeah, that was the night we shot that scene. Also the night it was like storming. It's like a hailstorm outside.
Oh my God.
So that happened. And then also in the bar scene at Cataclysm, there's a guy in the background that's juggling. And I didn't catch it for the longest time, but
it wasn't me,
but, there was like a guy, I guess he was one of those extras that like really wanted to be featured in some way. And like, I was too busy to, you know, in RE8, like we were all so busy, but there's a guy in the deep background with these giant neon balls, just like juggling while everybody else is having a drink and like having a party time dancing. Like there's a guy just juggling.
That's amazing. Yeah. Wow.
Those are good.
Yeah, those are really good. Thank you. And you gave us two. Yeah. It's funny because sometimes we've had people answer and it's like a really controversial thing. And other people are like something about like craft services. But it's like, hey, all answers are welcome. Yeah. Well, I just want to say, number one, congratulations on this movie. So it is streaming on demand on, do we have to just to plug it? Do we have to, or is it just, because I found it very easily like on Vudu, but are there specific services it's streaming on that we should plug or...
I know for certain it's going to be on Amazon, Vudu, iTunes, Fandango Now.
Google movie or play or whatever.
And then the international dates are actually staggered. We've sold the movie to actually 54 countries. So that's going to be throughout the year staggered, but March 5.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, yes, again, so congratulations and thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
So
this
much.
Was a lot of fun. We hope you had fun too. And everybody, look out for Dreamcatcher on wherever you stream movies. And we hope to stay in touch and yes, best of luck and on moving forward and all the success in the world.
Yeah. Thank you so much. This was a blast. You guys are great.
Awesome. Yeah, awesome. Well, thank you so much and take care. Enjoy your weekend.
Okay. Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Okay. Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Happy Horror Time. We're so happy you've taken the time to check out our podcast.
This podcast is hosted by Tim Murdoch and myself, Matt Emmert. It's co-produced by Jacob Randall.
You can find Happy Horror Time on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, Happy TV, and many other streaming platforms.
If you'd like to stay updated on our developments, please like and follow the Happy Horror Time podcast page on Facebook. You can also follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Happy Horror Time.
And if you'd like to contact us, send an email to happyhorrortime@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your thoughts, your movie recommendations, and any horror celebrities you'd like us to interview.
To support the podcast, please visit patreon.com/happyhorrortime and sign up to be a patron. That'll give you access to our growing library of bonus episodes. Our goal is to release at least one bonus episode per month.
I'm Tim Murdoch.
And I'm Matt Emmert.
And thanks again for listening to
Happy Horror Time.